Druze have been slaughtered in Israel, and we're fighting for our lives. What is the question? Where is the controversy?
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
With Shai Davidai.
My guest today is the founder of Manhattan Jewish Experience, MJE, which we will talk a lot about today. And I am very, very humbled and grateful to say, here I am with Rabbi Mark Wilds.
Here I am too. It's an honor and a pleasure, Shai. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I know you're a very, very busy man. I've seen you do a lot of stuff. So thank you for taking the time. If it's okay, I'm going to call you Mark.
Mark is better.
I'll be honest. I never know. Rabbi is a term of respect, and I 100% fully respect you, but I never know how to talk with a rabbi.
Mark is, I'm much more comfortable.
The
rabbi term makes me uptight sometimes too.
Does it change?
It formalizes everything. You know, you put on a jacket and make yourself a little more formal. You give yourself a title. But a rabbi just means a teacher. A rav is Hebrew, as you know, for teacher. We're supposed to be educators. I guess you have to look up to your educators in order to want to learn from them. But at the end of the day, we're supposed to be sharing wisdom.
It's interesting because I hate it when people refer to me as Professor Davidai or Professor. And I said, just call me Shai and I tell my students the first day, like, I don't care what you call me as long as you show some respect.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
So this time I will call you Rabbi just for this specific question. Rabbi Mark Wilds, what kind of a Jew are you?
Whoa. So I consider myself passionate about my beliefs and my commitment to my Yiddishkeit, to Judaism, to Jewish tradition, to Torah, to mitzvot. And I also consider myself a kind of Jew that really wants to be connected to other Jews of all stripes and as many non-Jews as I can too. I do pride myself. I just love meeting people that are not like me or that don't necessarily think like I do. And I just enjoy sharing. Since I was a kid, whenever I heard an interesting idea, whether it was a Jewish concept or it was an idea from philosophy, I always love being that person that shares it with someone else and see that little twinkle in someone's eye when they learn something new. I'm sure as a professor, you get a kick out of that too. But that's the kind of Jew that I am. It's someone that really is inspired when other people get inspired.
And where is that commitment coming from? Where is that passion coming from?
I think my dad, you know, my father, unfortunately, just, I'm still in the year of mourning.
Passed away this January,
he
right?
He just passed away, yeah. And so my dad was, thank you. My dad was my hero, and he was an immigration lawyer, and he brought lots of people to this great country who otherwise couldn't get in. And he loved just people of all stripes. And every night he'd come home with another story of somebody from some other country who was living in oppression or wasn't getting the freedom that they felt they were entitled to. And he just loved being that person that helped them come. And most of his personal relationships were his clients, the people that he helped bring to this country. And he was very idealistic in that sense. And he was always there for the underdog. And I grew up with that. And he got me involved as a kid in Soviet Jewry. And my work with Soviet Jewry in the mid to late 80s when I was in college and graduate school, that's actually how I got to Columbia.
But before we get to that, what do you mean he got you involved? What did that look like for you as a kid, the involvement?
He brought a woman to our home for Shabbat. Her name is Carmela Raiz. She was a long-term refusnik in the former Soviet Union. She played for the Vilna Philharmonic. She was a musician. And she and her husband became Balei Tshuva. They returned to Judaism in Russia, in Vilnius, against all odds. And they just tried leaving and going to Israel. They became ardent Zionists, and they wanted to come to Israel in the former Soviet Union. You know, that was almost impossible. And she came to our home because in a last-ditch effort, my dad got her a visa to come to the United States to lobby Congress to enable her family to leave. And there was something about this woman that just like inspired me.
How old were you? Do you remember?
I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And it just opened my eyes to the whole plight of 3 million of our Jewish brothers and sisters that were caught behind the Iron Curtain for decades. I think Elie Wiesel called them the silent Jewry. Yeah. And it just had everything. The whole Soviet Jewry movement had like everything that to me was inspirational. They were dissidents, but they were also drawn to Jewish tradition from which they had been deprived since communism. And they just wanted to live as Jews. Some wanted the religion, some just wanted the nationalism of being Jewish. A lot of them wanted to go to Israel, some of them wanted to come to the United States. And that just turned me on. But it was really my dad. He was very devoted to his clients, and he was very involved in the Jewish community at large. And he did it in a quiet, modest way. He wasn't like a kind of person. He was more of a quiet doer. And he was a brilliant legal scholar. He taught in law school for over 30 years. I took his course.
If I, 10, 20 years from now, interview your kids who are in their 20s and, you know, when they're full adults in their 40s, what would they say about you as a dad?
Gosh, I hope they'd say something like I just said about my father.
That's the hope.
I'm very close with my kids. I love them dearly. And they grew up in a home where every Shabbat there were 20 strange people. When I say strange people, I mean they weren't
strangers.
Strangers who come to our Shabbat table. And I think that had a lot to do with their upbringing. And I think they would probably talk about something like that.
Wait, so tell me about these Shabbat dinners.
Oh, that's the best. Every week, my wife and I, we start on Monday, and we start, who's been coming around MGE? Who have we met just in our personal interactions with other people that didn't really grow up with Shabbat and would appreciate like a Shabbat meal with the family and would appreciate meeting others? Because something I'm really proud of, we have 369 couples that have met and married through MGE in the last 26 years. I'm very proud of that number.
369 couples. Yeah. So you don't run a Jewish experience, you run a matchmaking agency.
Basically. I mean, I didn't really set out to do that. I really wanted to teach Torah, and I wanted to inspire people in Jewish philosophy. You know, if you keep hosting enough 20s and 30s at your Shabbat table.
So what happens, you know, at your Shabbat table?
People just meet, and it's organic, and it's fun. And now, they didn't all meet at our table. MG does dozens of programs, just hundreds of programs a year, at which we have hundreds of 20s and 30s. So just the statistics, you know.
Yeah.
You get enough single Jews together, hopefully this is going to emerge. But I would love if my kids, after I'm gone, would say that, you know, my dad brought a lot of people together and brought a lot of Jews back to their roots.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about Manhattan Jewish experience. I want to go into detail into that, but do you have an elevator pitch, like a two-sentence thing? What is Manhattan Jewish experience?
So Manhattan Jewish experience is really giving a second chance to young Jewish men and women that, in my opinion, were not introduced to Judaism ever in the right way or at all.
So what does that second chance look like?
The second chance
who's looking for a second chance?
I think people, I don't know how many young Jews are actually looking for another way back into their Judaism, because if you're not raised to really appreciate it, you're not going to look for it. But there's something that everybody wants. Everybody wants to belong to a community and be part of something that's bigger than themselves. And I grew up as part of a Jewish community. I'm from Forest Hills, Queens. I went to a synagogue. There was this chevra, and there was a rabbi, and there was just vibrancy and passion and excitement and singing and Israel. And it was just second nature. I didn't even think about it. And then I realized that, like, most American Jews don't grow up like that. Most American Jews grow up going to temple or synagogue or feeling a sense of community two or three times a year. And they're lacking because of that.
I would say most Americans don't grow up like that.
Yeah, right? True.
One of the reasons why this, they call it the Free Palestine Movement, the real, like, the support for our terrorism movement has caught like wildfire, is because it gives people a ready-made instant community. Yeah. All you have to do is wear this thing, chant these chants, you know, believe in this thing, and you are part of the community.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. There's no question. It's taken the place of religion for a lot of young people. And it's pretty instant. And it has all of the trappings of a nice Jewish community, if you will. Other people that are coming together for an encampment or a rally, and you're angry about something and you're going to do something and you have a platform. It's exactly what's happening. That's a very accurate.
So why do you need something like MJE, Manhattan Jewish Experience? Like, why not form a community around a political issue, or, as we've seen in the past 20 years in the United States, a demographic, or, you know, an identity that you either are born with or you choose?
Yeah.
Why religious?
Because if what is at the center of what's drawing you into whatever it is you're being drawn into isn't the right values, then what you're going to get sucked into could be something quite destructive. And I really believe in Jewish values. I believe that there is tremendous wisdom in the Torah, not just for Jews, but for the world.
And what are these values for you?
The values of kindness for other people, tikkun olam, which is repairing the world. The values of, I would say, self-growth, spiritual growth, understanding that we are not just our bodies, but that we have a soul, and giving people a path to explore how they can cultivate and develop their soul in a way that is not just touchy-feely, but has some substance and some intellectual sophistication to it.
But again, I just want to push back, because yeah. I think a lot of people will be listening and say, I can do a lot of that at the privacy of my own home. There's many, many books, self-help books, psychology books. You want to go more philosophical, so philosophy books. I don't need to go once a week, some people every morning, but to, you know, 86th Street on the Upper West Side and be there.
Right.
Why do I need the community aspect, the physical MJE?
So, I mean, I'll give you a sociological reason and I'll give you a theological one. Sociologically, you can read all you want, but you're not going to feel connected to other people. And of course, there are other ways of being connected to other people. It doesn't have to be through the Jewish religion. But if you want to be connected to others that is based on something which is greater than yourself and not simply made up by the group themselves, but really is beyond. That's the name of my book, Beyond the Instant. It's beyond ourselves. There's an authenticity. There's a validity. There's a truth to Judaism. And I know that not everybody who comes to MG believes objectively, this is the truth, this is the gospel. I do believe that. And I do believe because of this authenticity, because of this truth, it's going to resonate with people in a way that a lot of things that are being shopped around out there will not. Now, a lot of those things will resonate with a lot of young people, but they're not going to last. Judaism has withstood the test of time. I always say, you and I were just talking about the Beatles. Yeah. We're both big Beatles fans. Like, music that has lasted for so long, and that the next generation who weren't even alive when the Beatles came to this country, you know, in 1964 on the Ed Sullivan Show, there's some depth to the music. And when there's depth to something, it's going to last. It's something you can not only, you know, put your teeth into, but your children will pick up on, and your grandchildren. That's why we have continuity, because there's depth in Torah.
I love that. You know, I think, if I'm not mistaken, when the anthology came out, the Beatles anthology, must have been 94, 95, they had a new song that came out. Well, it wasn't new, but, you know, they finally finished it, Free as a Bird.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, it was the only band who've had a top 10 hit 30 or 40 years apart.
After they split up. It's unbelievable.
So you'd say the Torah is our Sergeant Pepper.
The Torah is Sergeant Pepper. And I don't think I'm belittling the Torah by comparing it to Sergeant Pepper, one of the best albums ever. No, but there's, you know, when something lasts so long and it still resonates with millions of people, thousands of years after it began, you have to ask yourself, what is it about? Because there have been a lot of trends and isms that have come and go. But Judaism has stayed. And why is that? What is it about Judaism that has this lasting power to it? And it's not just nostalgia. I really believe, and that's why I wrote the book Beyond the Instant, and I'm working on some more now, that if we can package some of those ideas, they're going to resonate with a lot of young people. And it's only because, and I don't want to say anything, God forbid, negative about young, smart people on college campus. These are your students, and they're my students. But if you don't have such a system already, then you're going to look for something. Everybody's going to look for something. And I remember growing up in Queens, they used to have these Christian missionary groups walking around. And they left the guys with the kippot alone. They never came over to us to try to convince us about Jesus. They targeted the young Russian Jews that were living in my neighborhood. Because the young Russian Jews who had come from Moscow and Leningrad in the 70s and the 80s, they just knew, not to any fault of their own, they knew little or nothing about Judaism. So they were like a little more.
They weren't told.
Yeah.
They weren't allowed to tell. Yeah.
So if you don't have that education, you don't have that background, you are easy prey for some other kind of ism. And by the way, you could be extremely smart and well-educated otherwise. But if you're ignorant in your Judaism or in philosophy, you can get sucked into these other systems. I've seen it.
But, and I think Manhattan Jewish Experience, you built something beautiful. It's not just a place for prayer. It's a place for learning. You have your weekly or bi-weekly like classes mm-hmm. that you teach on different things. You have a Talmud classes. It's a place for blood drives, for basketball games. It's just a place of community. And it's beautiful. And I really am with you with all the idea of tradition. But how do you balance tradition and what has worked so many years mm-hmm. with modernity and the new ideas that, to no fault of our own, the people that wrote the five books, you know, the Chumash, you'd say it's the word of God, but it was mm-hmm. written by individuals, even if it were or weren't the word of God. The Mishnah, the Gemara, you know, there are things that they thought and believed because they lived in a different world. How do you balance the modernity of today and the modern needs of young Jewish people with the tradition and the heftiness of history?
You have to put things in terms that people can understand. And Judaism also allows for a plethora of different views. If you study the Talmud, you know, two Jews, three opinions. We debate and argue these things all the time. But we do have certain basic principles of faith. We do subscribe to the belief in a higher being, and that higher being, you know, willed us into existence for a specific purpose. Not everyone's going to buy it. And not everybody is going to necessarily be convinced of the authenticity and the validity of all those ideas. A lot of people do, if presented in the right way. And I think we have compelling intellectual arguments. This is not the time to do that right now. But for those that do not, it would be very sad if they can't be part of our community because they have a different way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And we have to have a wide enough tent and an open enough mind to be able to allow people like yourself who don't necessarily subscribe intellectually to, you know, some of the core principles of Torah and Judaism, to still have a place in our community so they can still study our wisdom and get whatever they want. So some people will come, they love Shabbat, but they don't, you know, the kashrut thing doesn't work for them. So take a little Shabbat. I never subscribe to an all or nothing Judaism. There's no indication in the Torah itself that you either do the whole thing, accept all the philosophy, or just reject it and go about your daily life. There is something for everybody.
Is there a Jew who would not be welcome at Manhattan Jewish Experience?
You know, I never, my answer to that was always, no, there's no such Jew. And it still is fundamentally. And I just did a clip on, I saw a pro-Hamas rally. And I did a little reaction, I don't know if you saw this on my Instagram, two Chabad guys running into the march, pro-Hamas rally, wrapping tefillin on some guy that was Jewish guy that was at a pro-Hamas rally.
Yeah, and I think he even had a Palestinian flag. And
so part of me was like, my initial reaction was like, whoa. And then I thought, you know, if anyone could use a pair of tefillin, it's this Jew, you know?
But isn't it?
But would he be welcome? Would he be welcome 100%? I'll tell you why.
But I do want to, because I saw that. So I saw that video a few months ago or weeks ago. I saw your reaction to it. And I don't actually know the English term for this. In Hebrew, you would say it's lehachshir et hasheretz, right? It's putting a kosher stamp on something that should not be kosher, right? I saw it as like, if Chabad is wrapping tefillin over someone who's actively calling for the demise of the state of Israel, they're basically saying there's some equality and like that voice matters as much as the...
Oh, you feel that way?
That was my reaction, but...
Interesting. But you could look at it that way. I would look at it the other way. I would be Melamed Zuchut and give the benefit of the doubt to those Chabadniks. Mm-hmm. That they're trying to pull the guy over to the other side. Mm. And that's really our job. And I feel very optimistic because the young people today, they're young. And they have been, this group that's become pro-Hamas, have been co-opted, but you never give up on a Jew. That individual, I've seen people change their mind. I've seen thinking rational people who had, in my opinion, ridiculous views on certain subjects, see the light. And that's what I'm trying to do. We're trying to educate and enlighten. And if we give up on that population because we feel that they're so, you know, and now you're persona non grata in the Jewish community, nobody benefits from that. And I also think that it, you know, it assumes that we can't bring them back.
So this is beautiful. And there's a big part of me that wants to be like that. But I still have to say, is there a red line? Like, is there something that they would bring into the synagogue or into MJE? Like, that's, you are accepted, you are always welcome, but that is the line I draw.
If you start advancing the cause of our enemies and you start supporting our enemies against whom we're fighting and who attacked us on October 7th, and you're doing things to help them actively, I can't have you. I can't have you at MG unless you're here to discuss the issue. If you're here to discuss the issue and you don't just claim, but you truly have an open mind and you're open to listening to the other point of view, then 100% you should come around. But if you are like, there's no way this is 100%, then I'm sorry, we have nothing to talk about. Yeah, that is the line. That would be a line for me.
What about someone like Baruch Spinoza? Would he be welcome?
100% he would be welcome. He would be welcome.
Because I think one of the things that, and this is where I'll be a little bit more,
because he didn't side with our enemies. He disagreed fundamentally with a lot of Jewish precepts and he went over to the other side, but he didn't work against us. That's my line. You know, I get it. Not everybody's going to buy into this, but you know, I have relationships, something I learned from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of blessed memory. he had friendships with ardent atheists who he deeply respected for their wisdom, their science, whatever it is their field was. But they listened to each other and they spoke, but they didn't work against each other to bring down, to bring the other person down. You work to bring me down, I don't want to have anything to do with you.
This is exactly what, so I don't think you're that different from Rabbi Sacks or in his path. I don't think there's many people that can be like Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, but in his path, because I have spent more time in synagogues in the past 14 months than I have in the previous 40 years. And my mom says I've always been an atheist, born atheist, didn't believe in anything spiritual ever. And I never felt welcome. Maybe this is also part of religion and politics are intertwined in Israel. I never felt welcome.
They are a little.
And I, after October 7th, I went to Anshei Chesed, I went to Bnei Ayashuron, I went to Rodef Shalom, and I came to MJE. Something happened at MJE that did not happen at the other places, which, incredible synagogues, but something happened to me, which is I felt welcome. And I felt not just as an observer, but as a participant. And on Simchat Torah, I showed up at MJE with my younger son, and you came up to me and you said, what's your father's name? Kind of caught me off guard, and I told you my father's name is Eli. He goes, Eliakim is his full name. And then I say, come, I want you to alot la Torah. You know, I haven't done that since I was, I went up, I don't know how you say alot la Torah in English.
Yeah, just you're honored with a blessing over the Torah, you know.
So you're going up. I've done that twice in my life. When I was 13, for my bar mitzvah in the Kotel, because I, even back then, did not want to be in a synagogue. My brother actually did it in Masada. And then 2 days later, so it was on a Thursday, because in the Kotel you do Aliyot LaTorah on Monday and on Sheni and Chamishi, Monday and Thursday. And then 2 days later on Shabbat, I went to the rabbi's synagogue to pay my respect to him and again, Aliyot LaTorah. And then 28 years later, I show up in Simchat Torah.
Fast forward.
And, you know, and someone wrapped the talit over me. And I think everyone there, you can see on me, but everyone knows when I'm an atheist. And it felt like they weren't forcing me. They were letting me do it my own way. And that was something that I've never experienced. I'm sure there are many other synagogues and rabbis that would do this. I personally have not experienced that.
Wow.
And that gave me hope.
I mean, that first of all, thank you. And that gives me the biggest nachas, because that's exactly what I'm shooting for. We call the organization Manhattan Jewish Experience because Judaism is not a spectator sport. It's supposed to be something that you can feel and experience. That's what observing a mitzvah, getting an aliyah, or just praying, or just going to a pro-Israel rally, I think it's part of one thing, of being connected to something greater than yourself. And I'm sorry that you didn't have that growing up. It's a shame, because there's something so empowering and so warm, and it just makes life great.
But I'll tell you, I think one of the reasons why I never had that, and I would love to have your reaction on how you would see it. As someone who is a secular atheist Jew, but also is enamored with Jewish life, Jewish history, Jewish text, just from a different perspective, a more pragmatic perspective, let's say, or historical, archaeological, whatever you would want to call it. Many of my experience, I've always getting conversations with Chabad guys, with rabbis, and it always felt like being approached by the car dealership salesperson who halfway through the conversation realizes this guy's not here to buy a car. And what is your reaction to someone like me who wants to come, wants to participate,
right,
but I'm not a temporary atheist or atheist until, like, I am
right
a secular atheist, period. I'm not here to buy. Like, What is the role for people like me, which a lot of people that I think want to get more involved?
You know, in the 1950s, most Jews who came to Orthodox synagogues were not religiously practicing Jews, but they liked being part of the community, and they liked hearing the Torah being read on Shabbat, and they liked the rabbi's sermon, and they liked the trollant at the Kiddush at the end. And nobody asked them, you know, are you going to get in a car when you leave here? Are you going to put on tefillin tomorrow on Sunday? That's your own personal, you know, decision and your own personal relationship with Hashem. That's not my job. My job is to offer opportunities for people to embrace Judaism on whatever level they want and to grow accordingly. Would I be happier if I convinced Shai Davidai, the brilliant Shai Davidai, professor at Columbia, that there's a God and that God gave us the Torah? Of course, that would make my day. It would, and that is part of what I do. And
to be fair, would I be happier if I convinced the brilliant Rabbi Mark Wilds that, you know, there isn't a God? Then I don't know if it would make my day, because I don't think you can convince someone of one or the other. But if you felt it, if it came from you, yeah, of course. But
that's not my end all and be all. We are, you know, it all depends on the person. When I meet someone who I feel, you know, is struggling and is looking for that wisdom and that insight and wants some demonstration, you know, of a God, then I will share with them the teleological approach, you know, the complexity of the physical universe, of our human anatomy, of our biology, that I believe it makes more sense to believe in God, that I will give those arguments and why we believe in Torah Sinai, that, you know, could it have been made up and all the different, I'm writing about this stuff. I believe in it. I'm a fully Orthodox Jew, but the Torah is very broad and it can handle Jews not believing in parts of it or not observing all of it. You know, I'll just tell you a story. There was a woman coming years ago to MJE, and this question you're asking, it really, she brought this to the fore. She was coming for about 6-7 months. And I remember, very bright. She had just graduated Yale Law School, and she was an attorney in the city. And then she just stopped coming. She came every week on Shabbat. And then she came to my classes, my wife, and then she just disappeared. I called her up. I got together with her at Starbucks. And I said, "We miss you. Where you been?" She goes, "Rabbi, you know, I've been thinking about it a lot. I really love coming. But I don't believe that the Torah comes from God. I believe in God, but I don't think I'm going to become observant." And I said, "Okay, I'm a little disappointed, but you didn't answer my question. Where you been?" Well, I just naturally assumed that if I'm not going to be a Torah observant Jew, that I'm just taking up a seat. Isn't that what it's all about? I said, "Did I ever say, or anyone on our staff ever make you feel like if you didn't buy into this whole thing, you don't belong here?" She goes, no, everybody's very, "I just assumed." I said, that's an incorrect assumption. I wanted to create an environment that was truly comfortable for everybody, which is why I try to stay away from politics. Because if you get too political in my position, it's not just like you could lose your 501c3 status. People will stop coming because you're too right wing, you're too left wing. And this needs to be a safe place for anyone who believes whatever it is that they believe.
There was a video that you put up on the election day of you and your wife walking to the election booth, or just coming back from the voting booth. And you said, "I'm not going to tell you who I voted for, but I did vote and I want you to go out and vote." And I was like, "But if I ask real nice, you know, like I want you to, like, but..." It's interesting because that is exactly what I do. All my activism is above politics. Do I have my political convictions? Yes. And on Shabbat dinner, I will tell you my political convictions, and I will fight for them, and I will listen, but I will also stake my ground. But me, Jewish life is above that.
But did you share? I'm curious. Did you ever share them in your class at Columbia?
In my class, never. I never share any of my opinions that have nothing to do with class.
With the subject matter.
Yeah, I teach negotiation. The only time when I say, "But this is just my personal opinion, I want you to know it, but you don't have to listen," is when I give a 7-minute spiel on why you shouldn't lie in negotiations.
Wow.
And I give him like, here's the pragmatic reasons. Yeah. Here's why it's not sustainable. Here's why it's hard to keep a lie while you're also having all these numbers and everything. And then in the end, I say, and lying most of the time is just wrong. But that's my personal
opinion. That's as far as you go.
But that's my personal opinion. Because that's not my job. My job is not to come and tell people what to think.
So it is challenging for me because I am giving over certain Torah wisdom, and obviously everything is going to be from your own personal perspective. And I know that, you know, if there was a conservative or a reform rabbi or a reconstructionist, they would be giving a different view because I can only give what I believe, you know, what I understand is, and I try to do it in a way that doesn't box out people that may not subscribe to it. So they could hear it and go, okay, I don't agree. I don't subscribe to that, but I still like coming and I'm going to still come and no one's making me feel because I'm not bought into that. I don't belong here anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's why, by the way, years ago, I got a call when Trump was running for the first time, 2016, I got a call from his campaign. Would I give the benediction at the Republican National Convention? And I was about to do it because I was like, oh, that's great. It's good PR for MGE or maybe not. And my friend who called me that was Trump's bankruptcy lawyer for 20 years who became part of the negotiating on the Abraham Accords, Jason Greenblatt, is a friend of mine. He's like, Mark, you know, I care about what you do. Ask a couple of your students first how they would feel before you say yes. Because 3 or 4 minutes in the limelight may not be worth. I called 3 random students out of the, I said, how would you feel like if I gave the benediction at the Republican? It was like, pause, all 3. Rabbi, I would lose complete respect for you and I would stop coming to MG. It was very sharp. And I just said to myself, it's just not worth it. I've worked for 25 years to build an open, warm feel and this is going to remove it because they're going to think I'm a Trumper. And honestly, if the Democratic Party would have called me, I would have done the same thing. It wasn't because it was a Republican. It was, you know, I was giving a bracha that God should bless their efforts, you know, their political efforts on behalf of this great country. But, you know, Trump is a very divisive, very polarizing character. And so I think I made the right decision. And I try to keep my political opinions to myself and try to create an open place. Because I don't want to lose my, you know, we talked about authority. I don't want to lose my edge that people will listen to what I say because of they just put me in that box.
I want to, but there's one thing that you do talk about, which is not politics, and it's Zionism. And I do want to bring a quote. I was reading essays and speeches by Louis Brandeis, who was the first Jewish Supreme Court justice. And this is something that he said very, very early on in his career in early 20th century. He said that it's become clear to him that to be good Americans, we must be better Jews. And to be better Jews, we must become Zionists.
Wow.
And your congregation, your Manhattan Jewish experience is very, very Zionist. You have annual trips to Israel. You walking in, it feels like this could be happening in Israel. Tell me about that connection. Why is Israel such a central part, not a peripheral part, not a also not we care and we care, but it feels like it's in part of the
world. It's a fundamental thing. It's a religious thing for me. And I try to, it's not a political thing. Yerushalayim is mentioned hundreds of times in Tanakh. Israel is the whole focal point of Avraham, Lech Lecha, to go. He was told to go to Israel. You can't read the Torah. You can't read Tanakh. You can't read biblical Old Testament literature without seeing how central it is to the narrative and to our history and our people. And the political entity of Zionism, Theodor Herzl's political Zionism, which is not about Torah, and it's not about the biblical perspective on the land, is the physical framework through which we can come back to Israel and we can live there, because we live in modernity. We live in, and you need a government and you need an army and you need, I think, democracy in order for it to be effective and fair. And therefore, I'm a big supporter, because how can you be a Torah Jew and not be into Israel? And to me, it's irrelevant that those who founded the state were not necessarily with this ideology, although Ben-Gurion was a very Tanakh-oriented Jew.
Yeah, was a non-believer, but yeah, you know, but very, very deep in, like, if you read the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And there's a lot there. Now, I'm also, I consider myself a religious Zionist, Rabbi Soloveitchik, who all of my teachers were his students, and I consider myself sort of intellectually in his camp. And he broke with the Aguda. The Aguda was the most established and prominent Orthodox rabbinic association that his father and his grandfather were leaders in. He broke with them over Zionism because they were anti-Zionist, because the Zionist movement was spearheaded by individuals that were not with the spiritual game. You know, they weren't religious personalities. Some of them were anti-religious. So they couldn't accept, they felt they couldn't, but Rabbi Soloveitchik believed that what happened in 48 and Herzl's developing, he just could not see this as just some other national movement. This was the Jewish national movement. And therefore, he joined the ranks of Mizrahi, which I don't know if you're familiar, the religious Zionist group. And he brought all of modern Orthodoxy along with him. And also, I'm very inspired by Rav Kook, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel, who was more of a mystical thinker, whose Zionism was more wrapped up in messianism, in the Mashiach. He very much believed, and he didn't even live to see the creation of the state. But he was very inspired by the return of Jews in the late 1800s, early 1900s to Israel. He was seen on these very secular, anti-religious kibbutzes hugging the chalutzim, the early pioneers. He thought they were bringing the Mashiach.
And, yeah. Why don't we have more of that now?
So there is a, you know, I'm happy you're asking me about this because I feel very strongly about this. There are so many of these types of Jews living in Israel and in America. They don't make enough noise. They don't. Most people associate religious Jews with being ultra-Orthodox because they're a little more distinct and less integrated into the secular world. And they're not so with the Zionist. There are so many numbers-wise. 25 to 30% of the IDF today are religious Zionist Jews. So many of the boys whose lives have been taken in these last few months are wearing kippot with a tzitzit out, who studied in yeshiva where my son is about to start in a few weeks. And they just, I don't know, they don't make as much noise or they don't get as much publicity. There's tons and tons of Jews like this.
I'm working on creating what I like to call the loud moderates, right? People think because my voice is very loud, my actions may seem radical. If you really think of what I say, if you really look at what I do, it's actually very moderate. But we've gotten used to, if you're loud, you're an extremist. If you're quiet, you're a moderate. And I want to say, no, you can be a loud
moderate. Well, we need that because we have to stop associating, you know, Zionism with those that are, you know, not religious. You know, like it's not the reality anymore.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that Zionism has been come to be perceived as either of the extreme secular, you know, people like myself, but with no connection to the historical Jewish roots, or the extreme West Bank settlers, that kind of like zealot Zionist, which is also, I mean, it exists. We cannot say it does not exist. It exists, and in many cases should be condemned, but that's not Zionism, right? We need the moderate middle to come and say we are Zionism.
Yeah, so I just think that the future of the Jewish people is in Israel. I don't think, as I've invested
and you walk the walk.
You know, I walk the walk. I live in New York City.
But we're you're old. You have one son who lives in Nachlaot.
Yeah, my oldest son. Yeah.
5 weeks. What's happening?
My youngest son Yehuda is making Aliyah on Tuesday. Next Tuesday. 5 days, it's going on a Nefesh B'Nefesh flight. Just means that it's free because he's officially made Aliyah and he's drafting in March. And I'm very, very proud of him. So I feel like, I guess through my children, I'm being consistent. You know what I mean? I because I'm a little of a hypocrite. I very much believe in being intellectually honest. If I was really true to my beliefs, I'd be in Israel. But, you know, my rabbis have told me, and I believe this, that, you know, I live in New York City because I want to try to bring some other Jews on board. Mm. And I can't really do that in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem as much. I can do that here in New York City. But I guess I've sufficiently brainwashed my own children to want to go there and live there and serve.
I think, honestly, I think being a Jew inherently means dealing with hypocrisy. Because Taryag mitzvot, 613 mitzvot, right? No Jew alive can, because we don't have the temple, or right. is even getting close to completing all of them, all the mitzvot. And every intellectually honest Jew needs to ask themselves, okay, so why do I keep saying that all of this is sacred if I don't do all of it? You know, and if I just do Kiddush on Shabbat, I don't see it as a mitzvah. I do it as a community thing and family, but I still do it, right?
By the way, that's the most important thing. We don't judge people's motivations so much.
Yeah. So I do think there's that struggle of you right. know, Israel needs the Jewish diaspora, the Jewish diaspora needs Israel. I want to talk a little bit about your book, Beyond mm-hmm. Jewish Wisdom for Lasting Happiness in a Fast-Paced Social Media World. I'll be honest with you. I picked this book up because I was at Manhattan Jewish Experience. You had two books there. One was preparing for the New Year, 40-day
challenge.
It was a Tzimcha Torah. I said, missed it.
Too late.
Too late. I'll do it next year. But then I picked up this and you said, yeah, you can definitely take it. I don't know if I would have picked it up in a store.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also not the demographic. Like, this is for young 20-somethings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it felt a little bit like, okay, this is self-help.
Right.
It's
Jewish self-help.
I'm beyond self-help. I need other kinds of help. but I completely read it in a flight from Mexico City back mm-hmm. to New York City. And it deals with almost every aspect of Jewish life that is not in the synagogue. Marriage mm-hmm. and love. And sexual relationships and success and failure and ethics. There's one thing that's missing there. And I felt like I kept reading. I was like, where is it going to show up? Activism.
Mm.
Now, of course, you wrote this book in 2018. If you were to put a new edition.
Interesting.
How would you incorporate being Jewish, Jewish life, to what's been happening in the United States and around the wow. world since October 7th.
So the next book I'm writing is a basic Judaism book. It's going to be 3 volumes. And it has a section on Tikkun Olam, which is really our concept of activism. The Torah wants us to not simply, it wants us, as Rabbi Sacks wrote in one of his books, to repair a broken world. We are supposed to do that. If we see injustice, and this is something Jews have excelled at, religious and not religious, everybody takes Tikkun Olam seriously. And it is a meta mitzvah, I like to call it. And if we see an injustice, certainly against our own people, we have to speak out. And we got very good at speaking out on behalf of other people's injustices. Right. We're not as good on our own. And that's what we need to do. And I think you, Shai, and I'm not just saying this to compliment you, you represent an entirely new phenomena of a Jew that is speaking up on his or her behalf loudly and proudly and is not coming from the Orthodox world, is not coming from religious background. We don't have a lot of that. We have a lot of, I don't want to say your types, But we have a lot of academics like yourself, intellectuals, standing up for every other group. And by the way, that's amazing. But we've shortchanged ourselves. And activism is a major, major part. Al ta'amud al dam re'acha. The Torah says explicitly, do not stand by idly by the blood of your brother. And if you walk by somebody and you're a doctor and you don't help that individual, then you are in violation of a Torah principle. As a lawyer, I will tell you, there is no such law in America. There are some Good Samaritan laws that protect doctors, you know, from gross, short of gross negligence. But you can't be hauled into court for failing to help somebody, unless you're like a lifeguard and you fell asleep or you decided not to help the drowning person in the ocean, God forbid. In Judaism, you are violating the Torah if you remain silent. And being vocal and loud, and I got my training with the Soviet Jews. I went to rallies in the 80s and 90s for Soviet Jews. I went to Washington. I lobbied on behalf of Soviet Jewry. I worked for my senator, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. I worked in his office, and I worked in Gary Ackerman's office, my congressman from Queens. And that's the great thing about this country. I was taught at a very young age, you can make a difference. And I was taught by Torah, by my rabbis, that you must make a difference. And if not, you are shirking your Jewish responsibility. And I don't care how many times you put tefillin on or how much you observe Shabbat, if you don't show up at that rally, and I was very, very upset. This was going on. There was a big rally, as you know, in Washington. MGE, we sent buses. Everybody went. And then there was a big discussion about whether the more, you know, Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox parts were going to send buses. And I was like, why are we having this conversation? Jews have been slaughtered in Israel, and we're fighting for our lives. And you're not going to get on a bus and stand with a few hundred. What is the question? Where is the controversy here? What's the issue? And it's al talmud al dam re'acha. Because if you can do something in America, right? We're not fighting, and it is a milchemet mitzvah, according to halacha. Every rabbi in Israel says it's a milchemet mitzvah, which means it's a mandatory war. You have to go and serve. I don't know the justifications.
Again, with the political climate in Israel, not every rabbi, many, many ultra-Orthodox don't serve. And many, I think, because they're leaders, I don't know if they're spiritual leaders or political leaders, are telling them not to serve. But you're right.
They believe that they're helping.
They're serving by studying
and by praying. And, you know, and I hear that. I hear that, but we don't have to go that route right now.
Yeah, we don't have to. Yeah. No, I just wanted to put that as
I want your listeners to hear that from the Torah's perspective, you're not in keeping with a fundamental commandment.
I have to tell you, because you keep bringing up as a young kid, as a teenager, being taken to the rallies, the protests for the Soviet Jewry. That's how I see my role in taking my kids, my 8-year-old son, my 3-year-old daughter, to the March for the Hostages every week
Sunday.
In Center Park.
Yeah.
For me, when my 3-year-old daughter, we say like, are you ready? We need to go. And she says, oh, are we going to bring them home? That's what she said. Mm-hmm. And where did she learn Hatikva? 3-year-old. She learned it at the march. Where, you know, that's to me, that's part of the activism.
It's so important.
I do want to say, so, and also, and by the way, you do touch on one thing, maybe not on activism, but we really talked to me in your book, Beyond the Instant, you say ethics over etiquette, which if anyone has been even slightly paying attention to me in the past 14 months, they know I have very little etiquette. I can turn it on. It's not that I don't know the etiquette. My Safta Lydia taught me a lot. You know, I know which fork and which knife goes to
put your elbows on the table.
And never put my elbows on the table. And you never, you know, I take off my hat if I have a hat when I'm eating. There's all these etiquettes, but ethics over etiquette. I don't do things to be liked. I do things to be respected or to get change. But there was one thing that I want to ask you about. It has nothing, or maybe everything,
to do with
Jewish life.
That's my favorite chapter, by the way.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's my favorite chapter. It's a beautiful idea from Rabbi Soloveitchik.
There's a part where you talk about marriage and the difficulty of getting people to commit. And you say, and I love this, you said, marriage is happiness in slow motion. What does that mean to you?
It means that I think we have a very distorted, we have a very negative view of marriage in the West. And it's unfortunately suffering. It's the butt of every comedian's bad jokes. And because we've had a lot of failed marriages, and young people are coming out of those failed marriages, they're very, very reticent to want to do this. And I think that we are shortchanging the next generation from one of the greatest joys of life, to grow older with another person and to learn how to really explore the depth of who we are by being with somebody else that's open to us. And it's in slow motion because it's a process. When I was a kid, I never understood, like, doesn't marriage get so boring? I'm married 28 years, we're about to hit 29. And I'm like, how do people stay? It must be so exciting, like, for the first 2 or 3 years, and then it just progressively worse until you just hate each other. Jackie Mason used to, like,
take my wife, seriously, take her.
You know, like, of course there's a certain excitement to something that's new, but the reason why a good marriage gets better is because you're slowing down and you're living life side by side. And because I have this theory also that we all change like every 5 years. This is my own theory. I think none of us none of us is the same.
There's a lot of Columbia administrators that are waiting for the 5 years to pass, so I'll change.
Right. So some of this is self-imposed and some of this just happens naturally. And, As we get older, we want to develop and we want to grow. And that's why the Torah refers to your soulmate as an Ezer Kenegdo. An Ezer is a helper. Kenegdo means against you. So which is it? Is your husband a helper or against you? And it's really both. It's someone who's your cheerleader, but they're not a yes person. Mm-hmm. It's someone who's going to say, look, I think you can do better. You know, when I'm nervous sometimes when I give over ideas to my wife before I write a sermon, a speech, because she's honest with me and she'll tell me anything from it's okay to that's crap. And you can do much better, Mark, to that's good, you got it. And then I take her seriously because I know she's being honest and real. And that's what, if you go through life, the opportunity to go through life with that, and that's just, there's no surety, there's no guarantees in life, but We want to know that we're growing, that we're not the same people 5 years from now that we are today.
Yeah, and I must say, it really resonated with me because, yes, marriage is hard. Married life is difficult. Probably one of the most difficult thing, if not the most difficult thing that we all do, maybe have children, which is part of married life for many. But I can tell you that I love my wife, Yarden, today, way more than I did when I proposed. And when I proposed, I loved her more when we first kissed. Like the love gets bigger for some reason.
Yeah, it develops. That's a sign of a good relationship. And that's something that doesn't stay the same. That's why it doesn't stay boring. But if you're coming out of...
It can get boring. No, I'm not, like, for young people listening, I'm not promise. Like, it can get boring. Maybe not when you are fighting anti-Semitism, but
right.
Yeah, it can get boring, but that's part of it.
Of course, that's life.
That's part of it. Being bored together there's no one else I would rather be bored with.
I mean, the other thing I say in the book that Rabbi Soloveitchik touched on in his monumental work, The Lonely Man of Faith, and I would encourage you to read this book. It's brilliant. And it's a description of the first relationship ever, Adam and Eve. And he goes on to talk about what does it really mean to be alone versus lonely. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says, you know, you can be in, he doesn't use this example, but I just bring it up to speed. You can be in Madison Square Garden and you can be in a concert with 25,000 people. So you're not alone. But if there isn't one person in that stadium or in the world that understands you and accepts you for who you are, then that's loneliness. Mm. And we are all plagued with this kind of existential loneliness until we can try to find someone who, A, understands us, and B, accepts us for who we are. That doesn't completely defeat our existential loneliness, but it helps us grapple with it. And that's also our relationship with Hashem also, I believe. That we all feel misunderstood. And to know that there's one being that has my back no matter what, to know that there's someone who gets me and still accepts me with all my flaws, that's the goal of marriage. And it's really one of the goals of intimacy between God and people.
We have to wrap up, but what reminds me of, I recently read a book by Meir Shalev, an Israeli author who unfortunately passed away in the past year. He wrote a book called Reshit. Not Bereshit, Reshit, which is like the first in the Torah. And the first time that the word love, ahav, the root, aleph, hey, bet, shows up in the Torah is, do you know?
No, what does he say? Was it Yaakov?
And it's Abraham and in the Akedah.
Asher ahavta, beautiful.
It's not love to God. It's not
it's
love
a father
to self.
To a son.
It's not love to wife or husband. It's your love to your son. And when I read that, I was like,
that's very powerful. That's very, very powerful.
I could go on and on with you. I do finish every episode with what I like to call the Jewish lightning round, a series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answers. You just say the first thing that comes to mind. Rabbi Mark Wilds, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I'm a really good drummer.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
Oh my God, one thing we don't know about the Jews. Oh my gosh. This is not so rapid, is it? We can entertain multiple truths.
That is a great, great.
Took me a little while.
Well, you entertain multiple truths on the way there. You can pass on this question. I feel a little bit awkward asking you this, but what is your favorite curse?
Oh boy. Oy. I try not to curse. It can come out. I think I use the C-R-A-P word. There's got to be some great Yiddish word that I can come. I don't really have a favorite curse. I'm just be honest. I don't.
When was the last time you cried?
I cried this morning when I woke up, thought about my dad.
He was a special man.
He was very special. And he helped me build this whole thing. And I'm very grateful to Hashem that I had him all the years that I did, but I miss him terribly. That's just what I'm going through right now.
Yeah. I'm sure he was very proud of you.
Thank you.
If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Probably the Rambam, Maimonides. I'd love to pick his brain.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
I love Shavuot. Shavuot is my favorite holiday because we get to reenact the giving of the Torah at Sinai by staying up all night. I'm a night owl. I love nights. I'm very sharp at night. And it's the only night of the year where there's a custom to stay up all night and to study and to learn. I love being up at 3 a.m, debating and discussing Torah with my students. The best.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Tisha B'Av is hard.
When do you feel safest?
My family. When I'm with my kids, my wife, my kids.
When do you feel least safe?
Too much alone, if I'm spending too much time by myself.
What gives you hope?
Jewish people, man. Young Jews give me hope because we're so dead. Young Jews in Israel are doing unbelievable things. People have given up on the young Jewish generation. Even in Israel, they are fighting so heroically. And young Jews here in the United States too, we just keep bashing them. And it's true that they've let us down and the woke and the... But I every single day meet such great young Jewish people who are smart, talented, modest, and want to learn. and want to grow, and they're open.
What's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the words Jewish civil rights?
The Torah. The Torah is all about that. That's where it comes from. Let my people go. Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus. We are the first narrative that has been used by so many other groups. We should be very proud of that, to enable other oppressed minorities, ethnicities, to find the freedom that they deserve.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Great organization called Widows of Warriors, that is taking care of wives of soldiers who have lost their lives in this last year. Widows of Warriors.
Widows of Warriors. Mark, where can people find you?
Instagram, Rabbi Wilds. On Instagram.
Wilds is Wildes.
And you can just go on our website, jewishexperience.org. I also got my podcast called The Wilds Cast. I had the honor of interviewing you, Shai. Yeah, that's about it. I do want to say something before we close.
Yeah.
You give me a lot of inspiration, not only because I had such joy when you came with your wife and beautiful kids to MJE. It really gave me a lot of chizuk because I have a lot of respect for you and the work you're doing and this podcast and everything you're doing. I think you're just a great inspiration to a lot of young people. You are.
I feel like I'm the Jew in me is waiting for the but.
There's no but.
Oh, okay.
there's no but. I think you can get to a lot of Jewish people. I can't.
Because I,
you know, as cool and down to earth and open as I try to be, and maybe am, I still am not a Professor Columbia, and I still am not. I don't know. You just have a certain voice that I think. When you came to MGE for that symposium, you sat on a panel and you spoke to people about their feelings. I'm still sometimes stuck in objective truths and intellectual right and wrong. And unfortunately, that doesn't resonate as much with this younger generation.
So I'll end this podcast by saying, when I came on your show, you ended with Baracha, a blessing. Which made me feel a bit awkward because, you know, I know how much that means to you. And it means to me in the connection level, but not in the spiritual level. But I want to have a bracha, a blessing as well. And my blessing would be that I hope that we can work together for many years to come in our different capacities. You as a rabbi, me as this loud, moderate, openly atheist, but together in our shared capacities as Jews and as people that care.
Amen.
I'm so thankful for you for coming here to Daraba. And here I am with Rabbi Mark Wilds.
Kasha, thank you for having me, Shai. Amen, amen.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."